In this next hour, we hear from retired Wisconsin Circuit Court and Court of Appeals Judge Charlie Shudson on his new book, Independence Corrupted: Decision-Making by Elected Judges. The book takes us inside the judicial decision-making process and illuminates the dangers, both those obvious and those more subtle, of a judiciary that's ideologically tied to the conservative right. The talk took place on August 1, 2019, at the Foley and Lardner Law Offices in Madison and was sponsored by the American Constitution Society and the Madison Institute. This is part three of a three-part series titled Court Capture, the Right-Wing Takeover of the Judiciary. All three talks are posted on the Madison Institute's archive page at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, all.net. But first, we hear from Jeff Mendel, president of the Madison chapter of the American Constitution Society, who introduces Judge Charles Shudson.
Thanks, everybody, for coming. I'm really excited to have you here for the final installment of our summer series on Court Capture, the Right-Wing Takeover of the Judiciary. I'm super excited about today's program because it really is different from the first two. Right, we've already talked about what the federal judiciary looks like right now and how homogenous it's gotten and what some of the consequences, the practical consequences of that are. And we've already talked about where some of the money is coming from and how it's being funneled around to fuel the takeover of both federal and state courts by the right. But what we have today is the opportunity to hear from one of the few people in the country who's giving sustained thought and has real expertise to share about how courts make decisions, what judicial decision-making really looks like, and what the consequences are when our courts are out of balance. So I'm really excited to welcome retired Judge Charlie Shudson, who is a Wisconsinite who went off to college at Dartmouth and came back to the University of Wisconsin Law School. He spent several years as a state and federal prosecutor early in his career. And for that work, he won a lot of accolades. One of the things that struck me was that he developed the nation's first battered women's program in a prosecutor's office anywhere in the country. Because his work was so great, in 1982, he was appointed to the Milwaukee County Circuit Court by Governor Dreyfus. He was elected to that court in 1983 and reelected 6 years later. And in 1992, he was elected to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. He served on the Court of Appeals for two terms, and he is now teaching and writing, and he's going to share some thoughts with us. Before I turn it over to Charlie, I just want to announce a few upcoming events. We've got two more book events in September with the Wisconsin Book Festival. On Friday evening, September 13th at 7 o'clock, the author of Cokeland, a book about how America is changing due to the influence of the Koch brothers and the money that they have pumped into America. And on Tuesday evening, September 24th, also at 7, also at the Downtown Library, Ambassador Samantha Power, former U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, will be speaking about her book, about that, her memoir of her life, but particularly about her ambassadorship. She's an amazing writer and speaker. If you haven't read or seen her before, she won the Pulitzer Prize for her last book, which was so affecting, actually, that it caught President Obama's attention, and he brought her into his administration because he wanted someone to share some of the views and the viewpoints that were in that book. And everyone who attends that event is getting a free book from a free copy of the book from the Wisconsin Book Festival. On October 3rd, we will be, time and location to be announced, but we will be doing a preview of a documentary called Fail State that is new and will not have been shown in Madison before, about for-profit colleges and student debt. So I hope you can join us for some of those. There will be more programs forthcoming, as there always are. But right now, I'm very excited to turn it over to Judge Shudson.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you to the American Constitution Society, to the Madison Institute. Let me There are so many acknowledgments I could offer, but it's a special pleasure to come back here having attended the University of Wisconsin Law School way back when, and then served on the law school faculty at Wisconsin for 10 years. There I taught trial advocacy for 10 years, and then at the request of Marquette University Law School, I developed a course titled Preparing Lawyers for Life. And it was such a hit at Marquette that then Wisconsin also asked me to teach it. So for several years at the same time, I was teaching at both Marquette and Wisconsin to try and help law students understand what in the world they were getting into. And it came at that time when, according to the Johns Hopkins Studies of Professionals, lawyers had gone from being in the middle of the pack on the key elements of drug abuse, divorce, depression, and suicide. And for years, Johns Hopkins, really, it's I don't know how many years, but generations, Johns Hopkins has been studying this. And for years, lawyers were right in the middle of the pack. And just at the time when I was a prosecutor and a judge, things changed. And at about that time, lawyers got to be, and still are, in the survey of professionals, number one in divorce, depression, drug abuse, and suicide. And I thought it was striking that in legal education we did such a good job, and I thought we really did a wonderful job at the Wisconsin Law School preparing lawyers or young law students to become successful lawyers. And they did often become successful lawyers, while their relationships with their spouses, their children, their own mental health, their lifestyling hit the skids. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not saying that we transform the curriculum, but doesn't it make sense that we at least offer one serious course that helps them understand what all that is about, why lawyers are measuring at that horrible first place level in all of those elements, so that they might be able to prevent that, and they also might be able to select certain styles in their own careers, so that they might be able to avoid such horrible outcomes. I would love to talk about that today. It is one of my pet projects, mini crusades that continues. But we have other things on our agenda today, and I'm very anxious to talk about those also. Well, this is a working lunch, so let me get right to it and outline what I hope to accomplish today. I would like to read briefly from the book, a bit from the introduction and a bit from the afterword, to give you a sense of perhaps what's inside. I'd like to describe what is inside and use that as the vehicle that will move us through the important question of how do judges really make their decisions, not how they claim to, not how commentators say they do, not what in theory they should be doing, but how do judges really make their decisions? And as a purely objective statement, however immodest it may seem, it is quite accurate to say that never has a book like this been written. Why? Because judges can't tell. And they can't tell how they really make their decisions at two levels. First, they cannot tell because they do not have the distance that allows for discernment. They don't have that more distant perspective that would help them reflect on, well, how did I really come to that? So they can't tell in that sense, and perhaps more specifically, they can't tell because they're not allowed to. And while we have 50 states with 50 different codes of judicial conduct, all codes and the model ABA code on judicial conduct are pretty darn clear that judges are not allowed to reveal anything that they got by virtue of being judges in those confidential settings. Whether trial judges in chambers, whether appellate judges in conference, we're not allowed to tell. And with good reason. Having been on the Court of Appeals for 12 years, I know that things would have been very different had there been a tape recording or a video camera recording all of those ins and outs. You have to feel comfortable to exchange and listen and learn and evolve. And that would be sealed off to a great extent if we thought we were potentially quoted. Well, so how do we get to this then? Well, I wasn't quite sure. After being off the bench for about 10 years, I knew that there was a book simmering. And this was long before Donald Trump was on the scene. I started writing this book in January of 2015. I knew this was simmering, and it was a book wanting to get out, but I knew of this limitation, and I didn't know what I was allowed to do. And so I wrote to the director of the Wisconsin Judicial Commission. And I said, here's what I'm contemplating. I don't want to just play fast and loose with the rules here. Can you help me define what I'm allowed to say? Here's what I would like to get out there. And after a considerable time and research, I got my reply saying, surprise, and it's probably going to be refreshingly good news for you. Because you have gone on emeritus status as a reserve judge, my title is Wisconsin Reserve Judge Emeritus, and because you have already informed us, unrelated to any writing you wanted to do, but long ago informed us, you were moving to Sedona, Arizona, and would not be available to take any cases, and you had no intention of returning to do that. He said, therefore, you are no longer under the jurisdiction of the Wisconsin Code of Judicial Ethics. And the only two exceptions, there are only two limitations on you. Number one, by statute, you still must not reveal the name of a juvenile in a case. And number two, by statute, you may not reveal anything related to the work of the Judicial Commission itself. If there was an allegation against you, you can't disclose that. If you were disciplined, you can't disclose that. If you filed a complaint, you can't disclose that. If you served on the commission, you can't tell anything about that. So those are your two limitations. And they did not limit my telling of what I wanted to do. There are, however, two very long footnotes about that where any reader would say, so what did you do? You certainly went to the Judicial Commission with this. And I explain that that was among the options. And I also explain why I'm not allowed to reveal anything about that. Now, that begs the question. Because now I know, okay, I can pretty much write about all of those things I otherwise am not allowed to write about. So legally, I can fit through that exception. But should I? Should I? And I suggest to you, and I run to the authorities in the first section of the book, in the introduction, where that fair debate is set up. And from that, I conclude that if in this audience today we had 10 Wisconsin judges, 5 would say, well, it's about time somebody talked about this. And you've provided the authorities that support the arguments for revelation, disclosure. And the other 5 would say, no way. Reasonable people may disagree. And I fully concede that those judges and others who might criticize me for having written this book are not wrong. They make legitimate points. I understand them. I try to give them their due. I try to articulate them as ably as I can, balanced against those that say, right. And for reasons I try to explain here in a very close call, I decided to reveal these things. So it is a book like no other. It is hot. It has gotten tremendous attention, and for that I have to acknowledge Donald Trump. Thank you very much. And it's not just Trump, but every time he opens his mouth attacking judicial independence, Amazon reorders books. And it's not just about what's going on now. Indeed, I'm sure to what would be his great consternation if he ever read a book, our president would only find his name in 2 footnotes. So with that, let me just run and see if I can help you get some sense of what is in here. And the book begins with this epigraph from Congressman John Rutledge, Jr. The government may be administered within discretion. Offices may be bestowed exclusively upon those who have no other merit than that of carrying votes at elections. The commerce of our country may be depressed by nonsensical theories, but so long as we may have an independent judiciary, the great interests of the people will be safe. Congressman John Rutledge, Jr., 1802, a prominent member of Congress and important to us in another way. Name Rutledge mean anything to anybody? His father. And his father, before John Marshall, was Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. So here's a member of Congress with a sense of what, at least in his family, was judicial decision-making, saying, basically, I would interpret it as he is saying, look, the executive branch will always be up to political shenanigans, and the legislative branch as well. And that comes with the territory. And we don't like it necessarily, but we can accept it and live with it as long as we have an independent judiciary that is able to draw the line with respect to the other branches. And the extension of that is then what 27 years later Chief Justice John Marshall wrote. The greatest scourge an angry heaven ever inflicted, the greatest scourge an angry heaven ever inflicted upon an ungrateful and a sinning people was an ignorant, a corrupt, or a dependent judiciary. And so after those two brief epigraphs, I open my introduction with this. Mugged in Moscow. Sounds like a bad movie, but I wasn't in the cinema. At noon on a sunny spring day, I was in a dim hallway on the wrong floor of an enormous old building two blocks from the Kremlin. A man grabbed my glasses and briefcase and pulled me toward an open apartment door. We scuffled, I regained my property and fled to the street. Down the block, I re-entered the building, found the right floor, and hurried to the offices of my sponsors, the American Bar Association and the U.S. Department of Justice. My mugging, I then learned, was unremarkable. Shouldn't we call the police, I asked. What police? American and Russian officials answered. When I pointed out that the thug, living or lurking just minutes away, posed an ongoing threat, they recounted their own attacks, some similar and others more serious. They explained that mugging had become part of Moscow life since the end of the Soviet Union 5 years earlier. That I was lucky not to have been harmed. I was in Russia teaching prosecutors and judges, first in Tula, the nation's weapons production center, then in Moscow, for a conference of the nation's chief judges who had come from all 13 time zones for this conference of chief judges in Moscow. I had been directed to address only the subjects the Russian government had specified, and those four subjects were organized crime, government corruption, courthouse security, and judges' personal safety. From that agenda, from my mugger, and from the weary response from the Russian and American officials when I reported the mugging, I started to understand Russia's post-Soviet circumstances. I learned more from Vasily, the former KGB official who provided my orientation. Formal, fastidious, and vigilant, he always sat right there next to me at my lectures. Pedagogically rigid, he threatened to cancel my remaining classes when, in answering a question, I strayed from the four-subject agenda to answer a question about battered women. And just before my lecture to the chief judges on organized crime, he warned with words I'll never forget, and I don't need the book to remember them. And his words, remember, half the judges in your audience take bribes on a regular basis. The other half worry about their lives because they don't. And he was not exaggerating. During those 5 years, the statistics revealed that judges were number two in the professional group being murdered, surpassed only by bankers. And organized crime that had a very, very symbiotic, cooperative relationship with the Soviet regime, but kept in its place, had rushed in immediately after the Soviets left and actually went to the police stations and took the weapons and took the squad cars and helped themselves to anything and everything they wanted. And during those 5 years before I had arrived, they had consumed all of those law enforcement duties. Indeed, fender bender, no police to call. Mugging, no police to call. And it went from street crime to far more serious crimes and right up to and including control of nuclear weapons. Frightening like nothing that had ever been seen, to say the least. And so, by being abroad, I started to get a better sense of our own country. And after leaving the bench, I was fortunate enough to serve as a Fulbright scholar for 5 years, teaching at law schools abroad, Germany, but particularly Latin American countries, in part through the University of Wisconsin Law School and its program in Chile. But then I returned as a Fulbright and taught a course at the Catholic University Law School in Peru. And every time I was teaching abroad, and I think now it's a total of about 10 or 12 countries, I, of course, learned much more than my students, but I also learned much more about this country. So I set up this book with the first bookend about the United States by reporting from Moscow. And at the very end, and don't let me forget to read that closing, we will start in Moscow, we will travel through Wisconsin, and we will end up in a graveyard in Germany.
You are listening to retired Wisconsin Circuit Court and Court of Appeals Judge Charlie Shudson on his new book, Independence Corrupted, Decision-Making by Elected Judges.
The first section of the book is the foundation, the theoretical foundation, because now from that little anecdote, we certainly know what happens, or from the epigraphs, we know what happens when a country does not have judicial independence. And part of the theme that I return to in the third section of the book is to say, history tells us that there has never been a democratic republic that has been able to survive without judicial independence. Haunting, to say the least, these days. And not just here. I spent a good deal of time in Hungary, and Mr. Orban and his attacks on the European University there, and George Soros, and all that's happening there. Poland, Argentina, you name it. The attacks on independent judiciaries are rampant and worldwide. So I work through that, and I try, as I think must, if I'm going to title a book Independence Corrupted, How America's Judges Make Their Decisions, I better try to define this thing called independence and go on to try and define this thing and identify corruption. And it's not necessarily what most people would expect. Indeed, many have taken exception to the word corruption in the title, and I'll come to that in a minute. But what is independence? It's sort of, we know it when we see it. We feel it in a courtroom when it's clearly there. But what is it? Where does it come from? Well, it comes from lots of very interesting sources. I try to identify them. The first section of the book is as academic as anything in the book. But a very useful starting point that all can recognize is just to go back to 1776. And there's Tom Jefferson writing the Declaration of Independence. What's the Declaration of Independence? We all know that from sixth grade civics. It's a laundry list of complaints. King George, you know, you're screwing things up this way and you're screwing things up that way. And what was one of them? Quote, unquote. King George, quote, made judges dependent on his will alone for the establishment of an absolute tyranny, unquote. And so it is not hyperbolic to say that we declared our independence in substantial part in order to gain judicial independence. Pretty strong foundation. And so what is this thing, independence? And I offer a lot there of the academic nature, but let's just set that aside for the moment, because I think there's a better way for us to visualize, conceive, define independence. And in the Yiddish tradition, it's defined by a story. Many are familiar with one common example of that, and it's not of independence, but people have heard the joke. How do you define chutzpah? And chutzpah is defined by a story. It's the story of the young man who murders his mother and murders his father and goes and asks for the mercy of the court. Why? Because he's an orphan. That takes chutzpah. So the story defines the concept. But what about independence? I share a story with you. Years ago, my wife and I took our two sons, probably then about, I guess, 9, 12. It was the obligatory trip to Williamsburg in Washington, D.C. And it was a wonderful trip. And, of course, we went into what then was really the only building of the Smithsonian Institute, that great old red castle. Among the exhibits was one on the three branches of government. And predictably, the executive branch, photos of presidents, and the legislative branch, how a bill gets to be a law. But how do you do an exhibit on the judicial branch? What, do you put a gavel in a display case? I don't know. And it was modest. And so, up on the wall was a display case. If we were to turn this picture, this framed picture around, it would be about that size. And there was only one thing in that display case. And it was just a... looked like a little pamphlet, white paper, smaller than this, obviously of several pages. What's that about? The words at the top of that paper were United States versus Nixon. And there was a hand-scrawled something or other at the top of it by the author of the unanimous opinion. And who was the author of United States versus Nixon telling the president, no, those White House tapes don't belong to you. The prosecutor has subpoenaed them, and you've got to turn them over. Who wrote the opinion for the 8-0-1 justice recusing, the 8-0 no to President Nixon? Anyone remember? The Chief Justice, Warren Burger. And the opinion begins, as we explained many years ago in Marbury versus Madison, as he lays the foundation of the authority of the Supreme Court to say what the law is and draw the lines, set the limits. Berger wrote it, and of those eight justices, he and two others were Nixon appointees. For me, that in the Yiddish tradition is a story that helps us understand judicial independence. It's having the strength, the ability, the understanding, the discernment to say to the President of the United States, who's responsible for putting you where you are, that I thank you very much, but remember from this moment forward, I'm tethered not to you, but to the Constitution. That takes chutzpah, or that is indeed judicial independence. So, I try and lay that out and give the historical and constitutional context for that. And then I move through from that Declaration of Independence history to the history of, you know, this little thing 11 years later. Look at that. I mean, that's the whole Constitution. But what a fascinating thing that in this little document, what do the founders do? They lay out the authority of the executive branch very amply, I guess, and then the legislative branch as well, and then they get to the judicial branch and they say a few things, and it's all about the federal judiciary, and then they get to the state judiciary, and what do they say? Exactly. They don't get there. Not a single word about state judiciaries. But to draw the contrast so significantly, what, in your estimation, might be the single most important thing they say about federal judges, both the Supreme Court justices and all other federal judges? What do the founders give those judges? Life tenure. How many states in America give judges life tenure? Right again, zero. Okay, interesting, but what's the point? Okay, what percentage of America's docket is decided by state judges? Anybody? 98.6% of America's docket decided by state judges. So, one of the things that I try to convey is that, of course, as important as federal judges are, and as naturally as we take interest in the appointments and hearings for Gorsuch and Kavanaugh and so on, honestly, I'm just not as worried about the U.S. Supreme Court and the federal judiciary as I am about the state judiciary. Because history tells us some things about those federal judges. I mean, remember what Dwight Eisenhower, as president, said was his biggest mistake as president? Earl Warren. What did George Bush first say was one of his biggest mistakes? David Souter. What we know from our history is that federal judges, insulated by life tenure, evolve. They are human beings who aren't automatically necessarily unfair or bigoted. They have to continue to interact with colleagues. They have to sit in rooms on a daily basis with colleagues, listen, get along, and with that, from time to time, learn, evolve. Not so in state judiciaries. Very, very different dynamics apply. Now, to break it down further, we have 50 states, and that's not the limit of our legal systems. And with non-legal groups, I go to great pains to say we do not have a legal system in this country. We have legal systems by design. And in that little constitution, basically the founders said, oh, yeah, we're not going to go there with the state judiciaries. They don't say it because they don't say anything. But implicitly, they say, we will leave that to the states. And each state has the authority to write its own constitution. And within that constitution, that define the manner in which judges will be selected. And what do we have right now? We have 50 states, 39 of them electing judges, some in partisan elections, some in nonpartisan. And to help non-lawyers understand this strange thing called federalism, I point out to them that the differences aren't slight. Just in June, I keynoted the New Mexico Judicial Conference, and only then learned that in New Mexico, judges are required to be partisan. You can't be on the ballot unless you are named as a Democrat or Republican. I don't know if Green and others would be probably allowed, but you have to be partisan. And now here we are in the Badger State, where you're not allowed to be partisan. The differences are enormous from one state to another in that and so many other ways. So we'll get there and stay with this. Not only do we have 39 out of 50 states electing judges, because of which states those are, that brings us to between 89 and 90% of all decision making in America. So the fact of an elective judiciary is very important. And the fact also, as I try to explain in part three, that even in Missouri plan merit-based appointment states, we have a highly politicized judiciary for many of the same reasons we have that in elective states. Does it make a difference whether it's partisan or nonpartisan? Yes, I thought so. I thought so as a judge in Wisconsin for 22 years. I thought it was a good thing, a meaningful thing, that I not only was not allowed to be a Democrat or a Republican or anything else, but I couldn't allow the appearance of that. Never a partisan sticker on my car, never a yard sign in our front yard, not allowed. What about my spouse's, my wife's powerful independence? And after 48 years, my bride, 48 years of marriage, my bride, and I know it's incredible to imagine, we don't always agree on every issue. And yet, she has to acquiesce in the appearance of fairness standard and not carry things around or display, and thus we come to the nitty-gritty in one of these cases. Because in the center of this book are eight case studies, four I handled as a trial judge, four I handled on the Court of Appeals, to really examine independence and corruption, not in theory, but in practice. And the first case I address is the one in which I presided over the jury trial and sentencing of Monica Migliorino Miller, director of Wisconsin Citizens for Life. Once again, Ms. Miller had a professor at Marquette, by the way. Once again, she'd been arrested for anti-abortion activism. Once again, she had crossed, or the question in the trial, of course, was that she allegedly had crossed the line of the criminal statutes in her advocacy. And we had a jury trial. First judge recused, second judge assigned recused, it came to me, and you will read about the interaction with the lawyers and with Ms. Miller on the question of whether I should recuse, in part because my wife had been active on the other side of the issue and actually had been a clinic protection activist. And we sorted through that, and I did stay on the case. And she was convicted, and I did sentence her. And you read about that, but perhaps most intriguingly, you'll read about what you might not expect. I ordered her incarcerated. She wrote me a beautiful letter, highly displeased with much of what I had done. And it was a beautiful, genuine, thoughtful letter, and I answered. And thus began a correspondence, reflecting on some of the very issues related to her case. And when it came time to write this, I wrote to her for permission to quote our correspondence. She, in the meantime, had written a brilliant book herself about her experience in the anti-abortion activism of her life that continues to this day. And given that I am so hard on what I consider judges who are corrupted, I thought I can't let myself off the hook. And in that first chapter, I identify 5 sources of corruption that could very well have influenced my decision-making and the extent to which I did and did not come clean about those. So this is a book very much about corruption as I have felt it. There's another chapter later in the book about presiding over the trials of skinheads. And on one of those, a lawyer, a very good friend of mine, a Chilean-American, whom I had hired as an intern years before, said, "We move that you disqualify yourself from this case. My client is a skinhead. He makes no bones about hating Jews, and you are of Jewish persuasion." I denied the motion. I did not recuse. I handled those cases and sentenced 2 different trials, 2 different defendants, sentenced them both. And you'll read about that, but then you will also read the portion in that chapter where I again take myself to task. And I ask, were the skinheads on to something? Was there something unfair about me, given the influence of Judaism in my approach to life and law? Is there something about that that should have led me to recuse? So I just note these cases to say that this is an examination of independence and corruption, including possibly my own. So what is this corruption thing we're talking about? I'm not talking about bribes. And during the week, or almost just a week or two ago, when we are commemorating the life of John Paul Stevens, we might want to keep in mind that he wrote, there we go, he wrote in a Supreme Court opinion that corruption can take many forms and operates along a spectrum where judges often suffer threats far more destructive to a democratic society than the odd bribe. And so I, propelled by that reference and others, I went back and looked at how corruption was perceived and identified at the Constitutional Convention. You know, it wasn't transcribed, it wasn't recorded, but we know a lot from the commentaries. And according to some historians, including Joseph Ellis in his brilliant Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Quartet, covering the transition from Articles of Confederation to Constitution, we know, he and others explain, that corruption consumed the founders. There may not have been a single issue of greater concern than corruption, but not the odd bribe. Oh, that too, but that's easy to identify and deal with. And if we go to the traditional definition or definitions of corruption, we can come out by saying it can be any factor at all, that influences what otherwise might be the merit, just the facts, just the law, merit-based decision-making. And so, viewed broadly in that way, we come to understand that corruptions are many and some unavoidable. You know what they are. Race, gender, age, one's spouse, indigestion, and indeed, I quote this study that's now getting more and more attention that came out of Israel, correlating judicial parole granting or denying decisions with time of day and eating.
You are listening to retired Wisconsin Circuit Court and Court of Appeals Judge Charlie Schudson on his new book, Independence Corrupted, Decision-Making by Elected Judges.
For better or for worse, we judges are human beings, influenced in our moods by the spat with the spouse, the indigestion from lunch hour spaghetti, whatever it might be. These things play out, and everybody knows that. And how do we know that everybody knows that? Because we know that today, any person in Dane County who might have some case, just learned about it, it's going to court, goes in to see you counsel, they walk into your office. Now this thing's been percolating. Now we know it's going to be going to court. And among the very first questions your client asks you is, who's the judge? And of course you answer, doesn't make any difference. This is a society where we operate under the rule of law. Why do we even care who's the judge? Well, no. Your client's on to something. What he or she feels in the gut is spot on. And the questions go on. Tell me about the judge. Black or white? Liberal or conservative? Young or old? Where's this judge been on issues like this in the past? Indeed, all of those questions pour out for a responsible attorney and a client, in part because what we know, contrary to what a lot of people claim, it is only Mother Teresa who wants a judge in her case that is fair. She wants a judge who is fair. The rest of us mortals want a judge who is unfair in our favor. And that's the reality. It's unavoidable. And to deny it is to deny the reality of our humanity and our self-interest that guides what we do. Not necessarily bad, but dangerous if unacknowledged. And in training judges, they're onto it. But a few years ago, I could go into a room of judges and say, all right, who here is biased? No hands. Now they know what this is about. And what I preach is that bias is not bad necessarily. Denied bias or unacknowledged bias, unaccounted for bias can be. And now, one of the concepts that I belabor in this book is to help people remember that when we say judge, we better identify what we're talking about, because there is the world of difference between a trial judge deciding issues alone, precluded in many ways from even conferring with someone else, and the appellate judge who decides cases with colleagues. And again, it's very easy. You don't have to be a lawyer. I just say to my audiences, let me ask you, any single parents here? Any married or mated parents here co-parenting? And powerful three-judge panel? Spouses and in-law living in the house. Now there's a three-judge panel. And does it make a difference? And so here I try to identify the very, very different decision-making dynamics of trial judges acting alone, appellate judges acting in concert. And the complexities are wonderful. I think rich. Not necessarily to be rejected, but to be welcomed. And from my experience, I can tell you that on an appellate panel, I want diversity fully out there and acknowledged. And the excellent appellate judge starts out not by sitting like this. I'll just tolerate what these others say, and then I'll explain to them my brilliance. And woe to those who don't accept it. But the wonderful appellate judge who sits there like this and is just bursting with enthusiasm as if to say, and sometimes actually saying to his or her colleagues, I'm so anxious to let you know my reading of these briefs. I think, what a great case, and here's where I am tentatively, and I'm so anxious to enthusiastically impart this. But before I do, I'm just as interested in hearing where you are on this. The great appellate judge is every bit as earnestly, genuinely interested in listening and learning, and then discovering what might have informed the woman, the African American, the younger judge, the older judge, and if then they together can build consensus or at the very least more precisely identify their areas of disagreement, now we're cooking. And now we're imparting something that has a very great chance to reach wisdom and guidance for the bench and bar. If only that could happen. And with that, we enthusiastically accept that some people, of course, have biases. Of course, I'm a Jew. Can I, should I ever decide a case without remembering my Holocaust heritage? Do I review a Fourth Amendment issue, a search and seizure, without hearing the pounding at the door in the 1930s and visualizing two of my ancestors who were on the St. Louis, denied entry in Cuba, though they had paid for it, coming up the coast and having Franklin D. Roosevelt himself say, no, you go back. You go back and burn. And then do I forget that they were among the one-third of the passengers on the St. Louis who survived and then came back and settled in Providence, Rhode Island? Have I seen America in my own heritage at its worst and its best? Yes, indeed. And so in the second section of the book, I work through eight very fascinating cases. Perhaps, you know, I could choose from thousands. I didn't go after the boring ones. On topics of intrinsic interest, not just to people in Wisconsin, because these happened here, but so that this book would serve a national audience. And then in the third section of the book, after studying independence and corruption through actual cases, I say that while all of these corruptions, some unavoidable, some even constructive in an appellate setting, while all of them can influence and compromise independence, there's only one corruption that can kill independence, and that's political corruption. Because without independence, without the chance to write United States versus Nixon, and have the authority, the wisdom, and the enforcement power to make that stick, democratic republics do not survive. People have been saying this for a long time. And let's go back to our old friend, who obviously had a crystal ball, Tocqueville, Democracy in America, 1835. And he wrote, under some state constitutions, the judges are elected and subject to frequent re-election. I venture to predict that sooner or later these innovations will have dire results, and that one day it will be seen that by dismantling the magistrate's independence, not judicial power only, but the democratic republic itself has been attacked. How did he figure this out? Well, I would like to spend lots of time talking with you about what happened in 2002, because I believe we very exactly can mark the point at which the judicial independence in this country went on life support. It remains there now. There's little time left. The issue most important to me politically is global warming. But if there's another issue where we similarly have very little time to turn this around, it's judicial independence. And so I would love to discuss with you, as I do with some groups, depending on time, the 2002 decision of the United States Supreme Court in Republican Party of Minnesota versus White. That would take some time. I'm happy to do it, but instead, I can provide that in another form. And I have written a very condensed version of part of part three in op-ed form to explain the significance of the 5-4 decision in Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, accepting the challenge of the attorney in Minnesota who is running for the Supreme Court, the state Supreme Court, was much offended by the Minnesota Supreme Court's decisions on abortion issues and violated the announce clause of Minnesota's Code of Judicial Conduct to say, hey, vote for me. You vote for me, I'm going to do everything in my power to get rid of Roe versus Wade. Abortion is a sin. It is abhorrent. That's why I'm running. and he was disciplined. And he challenged the discipline. He didn't win his election, but now he's in court challenging the professional disciplinary action against him. He challenges that, goes to the U.S. Supreme Court, First Amendment issue, close call, 5-4, no more prohibition of announce clauses in judicial codes of ethics. To be blunt, here's the simple difference. I had to run for office in Wisconsin numerous times. I frequently interviewed with labor unions and victim witness advocacy groups, and you know, everybody who might be involved in a judicial election. And when they would ask me a question about the issue closest to their heart, I would explain why I couldn't answer. It was something that might be coming before me. After 2002, that's different. And now if I try to weasel out or on principle back off from answering the question, I do that knowing that because of my failure to answer, I'm not going to get the endorsement, which is accompanied by a check. Who has the integrity, the strength, the fortitude, the principal position to take that position? And now, and then what have we seen? I once ran for the Wisconsin Supreme Court in an April election in Wisconsin. The voter turnout for that Supreme Court primary was 7%. 7%. And that was the time when any judicial race was a low-financed yawner. You and I know they are now high-financed screamers. Why? Because of the political interests in judicial decisions. This happened to an extent before 2002, but that decision opened the floodgates, and we are now living with the disastrous results of which Tocqueville warned. But it's not just Tocqueville, and it's certainly not just me, but who else perceived this and acted on it? Sandra Day O'Connor. She retired from the U.S. Supreme Court and then quickly announced that she was going to devote the rest of her career to convincing states to stop electing judges. And in concert with the University of Denver Justice Institute, she traveled the country, judicial conferences, bar associations, trying to make the sale, trying to make this case. Not a single state altered its approach. And so we come, so if you want, rather than going into greater detail about that, if you want, I have for you the little yet-to-be-published op-ed piece trying to make this point. I've also written a modified version that does it in the context of Roe versus Wade, saying what will happen state by state and how critical judicial independence is to what might happen. Now, at the risk of a terrible spoiler alert, I come to the afterword and share with you, I guess, how the book ends. To many Americans, judicial independence may seem theoretical. Its prominence in the revolutionary cause and constitutional formation largely forgotten. While casually respected, judicial independence is hardly an ideal around which we would expect the masses to rally. But not so abroad. Not so in China or Chile or Russia or Poland or Hungary or in Germany, where a few years ago I was a Fulbright Fellow at the University of Gießen Law School. I was hosted by the law school's wonderful dean, Professor Walter Grupp. In World War II, his father fought for the German Army. Mine served in the U.S. Army Air Corps. Walter and his wife Inga took my wife Karen and me to quiet sites, including a churchyard where many martyred nuns were buried, remembered for their righteous resistance to the Nazis. By coming together in true friendship in both teaching law and pausing at these graves, Walter and I felt we were honoring not only these brave women, but our beloved fathers as well. In Germany, many memorials recall what happened when judicial independence died. But in America, it seems we allow our memories to dim as if we want to pretend that that could never happen here. So we ignore our history of judicial corruptions and acquiescence, from Japanese-American internment to African-American mass incarceration, and we have yet to recognize or respond to today's unprecedented evisceration of judicial independence. I apologize and not for such a depressing message, but I don't have to tell you. And I'm doing my best on the strength of this book to ride my own Paul Revere ride to help people understand and respond to this crisis. I'm very grateful that you are part of that effort. So I thank you very much.
You've been listening to retired Wisconsin Circuit Court and Court of Appeals Judge Charles Schutzen on his book, Independence Corrupted, Decision-Making by Elected Judges. The talk took place on August 1, 2019, at the Foley and Lardner Law Offices in Madison and was sponsored by the American Constitution Society and the Madison Institute. This is part three of a three-part series titled Court Capture, the Right-Wing Takeover of the Judiciary. All three talks are posted at the Madison Institute's archive page at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, all.net. To find out what else the Madison Institute is up to, go to their website at themadisoninstitute.org. And to find out upcoming talks that the American Constitution Society is sponsoring here in Madison, go to their website at acslaw.org. That's acslaw.org.